You're listening to WOBC 91.5, Oberlin and College Community Radio. Welcome back to The Weekly, a roundtable show devoted to discussing current news and events in Oberlin. I'm your host, Johan Kappert. Each week, we'll discuss a couple topics uniquely relevant to the Oberlin community, drawing on our campus's uniquely strong pool of journalists and other students to discuss, debate, and analyze what's happening here on campus and beyond. We're live this week, and the show is open forum to discuss, debate, and analyze what's happening here in Lorain County. We value your feedback, so give us a call if you have an opinion or want us to cover a particular topic. Last week, we had a great conversation with somebody who called in, so you could follow up by doing the same tonight. Please, you can reach us by phone at 440-775-8139 or email us your comments at managingeditor@oberlinreview.org. And now, on to our show. Joining me this week, as usual, Daniel Marcus, the managing editor at the Oberlin Review.
Hi, Johan. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Daniel. Anytime. Sydney Allen, news editor for the Oberlin Review.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And Josh Collar, student senator and a member of the Student Trustee Task Force on Student Representation.
Hi, guys. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So our first topic for tonight is going back because of fall break. We're a little bit behind, but going back to sort of follow up on what happened at the Board of Trustees' most recent meeting and their decision that they made that everyone was sort of expecting was about whether or not to allow student representation on the Board of Trustees. So I think I'm just going to go out there and say it. They did not grant a student representative. That's already been put out there. But I think it's good probably to sort of go back to the timeline and look at how this whole situation played out. Sydney or Josh, would you mind giving us a rundown of sort of how things played out in the last year, couple years?
Absolutely, it'd be a pleasure. I definitely want to say the first concrete action in my tenure as a senator was in May of 2016 when Senate penned a letter to the Board of Trustees requesting student representatives on the board. But as it's recently been brought to my attention by former Senator Jeremy Poe, that this wasn't the very beginning of student sentiment behind wanting reps on the board. This had been something that students had been mulling over and talking about for a while, probably a year or two before this letter was initially written. Finally, we did write the letter in May. That was sent to the board via Oberlin's legal counsel. And about 5 months later, the board got back to us, letting Senate know that they had not actually voted on the letter. They didn't consider it in itself an actual proposal. They had more or less tabled the topic, but they were willing to, not really willing to discuss it with us, but willing to make a time at a later date to discuss it with us. Oberlin in general moves at a rather slow pace, so this was not a huge surprise, but a little disappointment. They eventually did get back to us. They formed a task force to put together a retreat to work on student senate and board relations and engagement, which I don't think addressed our letter per se, but I do think it was a great idea. I think that better channels of communication between the two bodies is always going to be a good thing and can absolutely still be improved. And following this retreat, Senate presented a new proposal to the board for representation. Not a proposal for representation, actually, a proposal to form a task force to come up with a concrete proposal that would be voted on. And they did vote to form this task force, and that was in March, and at the March board meeting. And from March till June, this task force, which I was on, put together a proposal for students to sit on the board. Eventually, it did go before the board. They more or less presented us that they had a ton on their plate, which they, you know, absolutely did. A lot of new administrators coming in, a lot of turnover, a lot of budgetary issues, retention. We're all, you know, fairly familiar with them. And they were not ready to give us a full decision. They got back to us with that comment in August. And from August to October, the task force continued to work with a little bit of aid from the new chair, Chris Canavan, and our new legal counsel, Donica Varner. And we put forth a new proposal, which is what you saw get voted on in October. And it turned down.
Great. Yeah, no, that's super helpful. Just sort of getting a perspective on the whole process, I think, is really valuable. And seeing, too, that it's not just a recent push, that it's had some history. And the board has certainly had time to think about it and sort of think about other the pros and cons. What did we hear back from the board? How did they release their decision?
Well, the morning after the final board meetings, representatives from the Review, the Grape, and WOBC, we met with President Ambar and Chris Canavan, the chair of the board, and they, for a media session, the first session that they've ever held, to just discuss everything that they, you know, had decided on during the meeting and really try and aim for some actual transparency with the student media publications. And they told us then that they would not be adding a student rep.
Can I ask, because, I mean, I sort of expect, you know, that message came primarily from Chris. Would that be a fair assumption to make?
Sure, yeah.
So then one thing that I'm interested in knowing, you know, in context of this, because we have Chris who represents the board, and, you know, if the board felt a certain way, he speaks on their behalf to say that they felt that way. I'm curious to know if at all President Ambar made any comments at that that session, because she's an ex officio member of the board, which means she's a non-voting member, but she's present at the meetings, and she's involved in the goings on to some degree. So I'm curious if maybe she had any feelings or opinions or thoughts of her own that she shared or anything like that.
No, she definitely did. She very much focused on where students could go from here. I think that was a big part of what she wanted to focus on, but she did mention that it was a very difficult decision for the board, and she explained that in this very transitional period, a large part of what they wanted to focus on was revamping their governing process. And so she did add on to a lot of Chris's statements and did try and support him through that conversation.
Yeah, I would add, too, because I was in that meeting. I think President Ambar was pretty much completely on board with Chris, and there wasn't a whole lot of daylight between them. But I think she did make a really good point, which was that even though this might seem like students aren't getting representation, that doesn't mean that the petition wasn't considered, and that students' needs aren't being considered. That, like, just because they didn't necessarily agree to our student rep on the board doesn't mean that this process didn't bring up the needs of students and sort of made them more aware of student desires in this area.
I think Josh has a reaction to that.
Yeah, well, I would just like to add, you know, that first of all, I think that President Ambar's, you know, response or lack thereof directly relating to the proposal is in line with her stance on it through this whole period, obviously, you know, just starting from once she got on campus. She's only been here for what we've had of this semester, but that she never expressed either explicit support or opposition to students on the board, which, while, again, you know, disappointing, is something I can understand given her position being new to the school. I think she's you know, trying to ensure that all her constituents are happy without taking any stances that could be perceived as radically for or against any of her constituents.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen what the reaction among the student body and maybe among Senate has been like to this announcement?
Well, some students I talked to, I think a fair number were actually pretty surprised. I think there was a very optimistic climate on campus that that this would pass and that we would get a student on the board. And I'm sure you can speak better to Senate's feelings and what you all have seen.
Yeah, I definitely, I would say disappointment as a key one. You know, I think that's expected anytime you put years into a project and into a proposal, and especially something that's so, you know, near and dear to Senate and Oberlin students' hearts and that we genuinely believe will benefit students, will benefit, honestly, faculty, administrators, and will benefit the board and Oberlin. I don't think this proposal would have been made if we didn't think that it would, if passed, if it would result in a better board of trustees.
Mm-hmm. I think Cameron Dunbar's article in The Grape, he quoted you, if I'm correct, saying this shows how the board is so out of touch with students, something along the lines of that. Do you want to elaborate on sort of your personal reaction to the announcement? Because I know you've been super invested in the process.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I've been, from the start, I signed Senator Jeremy Poe's letter in March of 2016, and I served on the task force for the retreat and the task force for the proposal. So on a personal level, it's tough to put this much time and effort into it and see what I think ultimately was a very mild proposal rejected. I really wish I could share every aspect of the proposal, but I've been told by the legal counsel that since it's part of Board of Trustee minutes, it's not available to the public. But this, generally speaking, it wasn't introducing anything that I think to any school, really, let alone Oberlin, would be seen as radical or out of the question. I think it was a really thoughtful and well put together push for reinforcing existing channels of communication and establishing, you know, new institutional channels of communication and access to the board, so that students could bring their knowledge, expertise, and point of view on student life and other issues relating to Oberlin to the board, whose job is to keep Oberlin a great school in perpetuity, and having students on there would only enable them to do their job better. So I'm bummed. I'm disappointed, and I'm disappointed in the rejection, and I'm disappointed in the logic behind the rejection.
Yeah, I also would like to add on sort of a personal note as the typically radical member of this show, that I'm frustrated for two reasons. I think the first and maybe the main reason is that in the email that announced this decision, one of the things that, or maybe it wasn't the email, but in announcing this decision, one of the things that Chris Canavan said was a major concern amongst the trustees was that they didn't feel that they could speak freely were there to be a student member added. And that's profoundly, like, disturbing, right? Like, that should make us all very worried that, like, they feel like there's a lot of stuff that they can't say, like, while students are in the room. That is, like, mortifying to me, and I don't even want to imagine the kind of things that are being talked about that, you know, students would be that upset by that they would feel the need to, like, leak private conversations from the board or anything of that nature. So that is really sort of frightening to me. And the second thing that I'm frustrated about is that, at least as far as I'm aware, and, you know, maybe something is forthcoming, I don't know, but as far as I'm aware, the result of this rejection of the proposal is sort of a stop. Like, there was no... It doesn't feel like a balanced negotiation where, you know, they voted on the proposal and the proposal was voted down, but then someone on the board said to themselves, hey, maybe, what do you all think about this? Maybe we could do a counter proposal of some sort that maybe the students would accept. Maybe it wouldn't be exactly what they wanted, but we could sort of show them that we are interested in working with them in that level. So that has not happened, and it seems, at least to me, unlikely that it will happen. And that means that basically the board's answer, as far as, you know, accountability and information is concerned, is too bad, use the channels that already exist, when the already existing channels are the source of why students are frustrated and sort of the source of, I think, the problem, in my opinion. So that, to me, is frustrating with regards to their response, I think.
Is that true, Josh and Sydney? Do you see this as a brick wall, sort of an abrupt stop for the push for student representation?
I'd say that... I took it as a pretty hard stop on the push for getting a student on the board. They did make it very, very clear in the meetings that I've had with them and the discussions that I've had with them that they do want to find more ways to better connect with students. And I have a feeling that's going to be an ongoing conversation and discussion with them. I'm not quite sure how that will look right now, and I don't think they are either. But... I have to be the optimistic one to Daniel's cynicism and say that I hope it will work out in the end.
And I would say I think the board is trying to leave this open for further progress. And I guess the sentence I take that from is Chris Canavan saying that he feels safe that every trustee wants as much student input on important matters as is feasibly possible. That's obviously a positive sentiment, and that's one that we share. But I don't take a complete stop from this. You know, I don't see a brick wall. But I think it's a big step back for the board. I mean, the board has made it clear that they obviously do not want students participating in general plenaries. They don't want students voting. They don't want students participating in Board of Trustee committees voting. They don't want students participating in those committees non-voting, with the exception of Student Life, who is able to call students to speak to them at their whim. And that cuts out basically all board proceedings. So I don't think they're trying to shut off all communication with students, but I think they're trying to knock out of the park this notion that students should be involved with the Board of Trustees and with their work and building Oberlin College in that way, which I do think is the wrong decision.
Yeah. I want to add something that President Ambar mentioned when we were meeting with her, and I think it was a very just empathetic and really a good point when she mentioned it. It was that, I mean, sometimes we cannot control what, you know, the bodies that be, the people in power, what they reject, what they accept, and she really emphasized that now's a time for Oberlin students of, like, Student Senate and everyone, all of their constituents, everyone, to kind of mobilize and find another way to work around this hard no by the board, that there are different avenues that students could take, and we just need to be creative about it.
Doesn't that make you kind of depressed, though? Like, isn't that kind of depressing? Like, oh, sorry, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out, and you just have to be creative. Like, it just, I don't know, that's like... profoundly unsatisfying.
Oh, hell yeah, it is demoralizing. What really bothers me here is the trust. And this is something that you mentioned earlier, Daniel. And, you know, I think there's certainly a lack of trust in some ways from both parties involved, but the fundamental lack of trust the board has in students, and that's extremely demoralizing to me, because that's something that's hard to combat. I mean, I can't change history. You know, I can't change reckless students' behavior in the past. Mm-hmm. But I can show for 2 years that the students in the future are not going to behave like that, that we care about the future of this school, that we are dedicated to the future of this school, and we will do whatever it takes. I can sign legally binding documents. I can risk, you know, everything I've worked for by saying, you've seen the 2 years of work I've put into something, and if something goes not according to plan, you can rip it all away. And I don't know what more I can put on the line than that to establish trust. And in some ways, I feel like a little, not a direct breach of trust, but it's tough having worked with specific trustees on this task force for so long and felt like we were creating something so positive that, you know, at least to my understanding, had the support of the group I was working with, and then see this larger body not rip it to shreds, but have such a lack of faith in it.
Josh, maybe you alluded to this. I'm not really sure, but one thing I'm curious is, you know, if the trustees don't trust students, why is that? Because you're saying that the students are willing to lay it all out on the line, their professional, you know, futures, and even their legally binding rights, you know, are being laid out. And if that's not enough, where does that come from? And maybe Sydney, in your research, you've discovered some of this. I'm not sure.
I can speak to a little. I'm familiar with a number of years ago. I want to say something around 5. I know President Krislov heavily advocated for student representatives on a board committee. I don't recall if it was investment or budget and finance.
I believe it was the investment group. Yeah,
investment committee. And I know there was a student who, you know, violated their NDA and did leak documents, and that's extremely disappointing to me. I wasn't there. I wasn't that student. I think it, in some ways, you know, clearly set us back a lot. Board terms are long, and I'm sure there are trustees on the committee who think of that. But I really think we've done everything in our power to convince them that that's something that, one, wouldn't happen again, but that is not in students' best interests.
No, I totally agree. I mean, numerous faculty members that I spoke to and administrators, that incident was still very fresh on people's minds. And I mean, it seems like forever ago for us because most people were not here at that time. But I think that was a heavy factor in why there is this bridge between the trustees and students and why they don't feel that they can have us in the room during these difficult conversations.
And obviously this is, you know, I can only right now speak for myself, but if you asked me right now, you know, what's more valuable to the student body, leaking documents from the board or having students in the room when decisions are being made, when changes to school policy, to capital planning, to, you know, all that are being mulled over, I take the student in the room every time.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree, and I just want to also say that, you know, I'm not convinced, you know, based on the year and a half that I've been doing journalistic work, that the cat's not going to get out of the bag anyway. Like, we've learned in the past, it's not even a semester, in the past 6 weeks, maybe, so much about how the board functions and what they're thinking of and what the president is thinking and what all these different, you know, bodies on campus are sort of thinking about as far as their work goes. And so I'm not even convinced that if you had a student on the board who would not leak anything, that it wouldn't get out by some other means eventually anyway. Like, we found out about the email in a leak. Anything that big, I feel like there's at least a decent chance that it would get disseminated anyway, but that's just me. I don't know.
I gotta say, you're making me feel more optimistic. No, the fact that you have a president who you feel is in conversation with you enough, or people around the president are in conversation with you enough to feel like you understand some of what's going through her head in decision making and other administration, and I think that's a really positive thing, because pretty much every aspect of the college needs better communication and transparency right now. Mm-hmm. So that gives me hope, Daniel.
Yeah. I would say, too, I think just the meeting that we had with President Ambar and Canavan was really helpful. And I know Sydney said that's sort of the first time that something like that has happened. And it sounded like it's going to keep going, and they're really going to put in the work to at least sort of have that recap of what the board is doing, which I know, in comparison, is very, you know, small compensation given what was put before them. But I think it suggests at least that two of the sort of, you know, quote unquote, you know, the chairman of the board and the president are at least engaged and committed to that. So I think that looks good going forward. Are there other methods or strategies that maybe Senate or students should pursue, like President Ambar said, to sort of take advantage of the board's realization that students want more representation? Where do we go from here?
I can say that you know, the legal counsel on behalf of the board has reached out to continue those conversations, which we're going to continue. The board has not proposed any alternatives to our proposal. I think that it's something that's not going to get dropped. Senate as a body has formed a Board of Trustees task force, or a working group, actually, I apologize, that most senators are members of, and I'm pretty sure a lot of work is going to be done in there developing next steps. You know, I think there's a balance to be had between pursuing this, not dropping it, doing what is best for students in terms of making sure that board processes and decisions are right for Oberlin students and Oberlin as a whole, and also making sure that we as senators are taking care of our community and taking care of student needs and not expending every ounce of our energy coming up with a counter proposal. But I would say for sure I would expect something to be forthcoming.
Great. Well, I think we're going to take a short break here. Again, if you have questions, comments, anything to add to the conversation, please do give us a call. The number is 440-775-8139. Again, this is WOBC 91.5. You're listening to The Weekly. Thanks so much. We'll be back in a sec.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Burr.
Sir. Did you hear the news about good old General Mercer?
No.
You know Claremont Street?
Yeah.
They renamed it after him. The Mercer legacy is secure.
Sure.
And all he had to do was die.
Yeah, that's a lot less work.
We ought to give it a try. Now how you gonna get your debt plan through?
I guess I'm gonna finally have to listen to you.
Really?
Talk less. Smile more. Do whatever it takes to get my plan on the Congress floor.
Now Madison and Jefferson are merciless.
Well, hate the sin, love the sinner.
Hamilton.
I'm sorry, Burr, I gotta go.
But
decisions are happening over dinner.
Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room.
Diametrically opposed foes.
They emerge with a compromise, having opened doors that were
previously closed.
Rose. The immigrant emerges with unprecedented financial power, a system he can shape however he wants. The Virginians emerge with the nation's capital. And here's the pièce de résistance. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens.
Thomas claims.
Alexander was on Washington's doorstep one day in distress and disarray.
Thomas Paine.
Alexander said,
I've nowhere else to turn.
And basically begged me to join the fray.
Thomas Paine.
I approached Madison and said, I know you hate him, but let's hear what he has to say.
Thomas Paine.
Well, I arranged the meeting. I arranged the menu, the venue, the seating.
But
no one else was in the room where it happened. The room where it happened. The room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened. The room where it happened. The room where it happened. No one really knows how the parties get to yes. The pieces that are sacrificed in every game of chess. We just assume that it happens. But no one else is in the room where it happens. Meanwhile, Madison is grappling with the fact that not every issue can be settled by committee.
Meanwhile,
Congress is fighting over where to put the Capitol. It isn't pretty. Then Jefferson approaches with a dinner and invite, and Madison responds with Virginian insight.
Maybe we can solve one problem with another and win a victory for the Southerners. In other words,
oh, ho.
A quid pro quo.
I suppose.
Wouldn't you like to work a little closer to home?
Actually, I would.
Well, I propose the Potomac.
And you'll provide him his votes.
Well, we'll see how it goes.
Let's go.
No.
What else was in the room where it happened?
No one else is in the room where it happened.
Alexander Hamilton.
What did they say to you to get you to sell New York City down the river?
Alexander Hamilton.
Did Washington know about the dinner? Was there presidential pressure to deliver?
Alexander Hamilton.
Or did you know even then it doesn't matter where you put the U.S. Capitol?
Because we'll have the banks. We're in the same spot.
You got more than you gave.
And I wanted what I got. When you got skin in the game, you stay in the game. But you don't get away.
All right, sorry to interrupt Hamilton, but we're bringing it back. Again, you're listening to The Weekly on WOBC 91.5 FM. Please do give us a call. We're going to be talking about the Office of Disability Resources and sort of the recent events that have played out there. To start with, I think we'll sort of do a similar thing. Could we just start with the basics and sort of what the Office of Disability Services does, and then sort of proceed into the timeline of what's been happening?
Sure. Yeah. Of course. Well, it is in charge of all disability resources for students on campus. So that includes things like offering students note takers, alternative listening devices, if maybe a student needs to orally write all their papers and just talking to a transcriber or something. It provides all accommodation notes and everything like that to teachers and just kind of is the interim liaison between students and professors.
Great. Yeah, well, and then I guess most people, unless you have a need that needs to be addressed by the office, I don't think would necessarily be cognizant of sort of what's been going on with that. But that all sort of blew up recently, especially on Facebook, and sort of screenshots of emails, things like that. Could we get maybe a quick brief of sort of what's been happening with that and the timeline of sort of employment and finding. People to work in the office.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to take it back for a minute, this whole thing seems like it may have been brewing for a while, but taking us back to May 2014, the office had 3 full-time staff and served about 400 students. Last year, we saw the, or I guess 2 years ago, more accurately, we saw the initiation of the Voluntary Separation Incentive Program, which was a buyout program that ended up in the retirement in a lot of the staff from places like the Comptroller's Office and the Dean's Office and the Office of Disability Resources. In January 2017, Isabella Moreno was hired as the interim director of the office. And then in May 2017, a staff member of that office, Joe Young, announced resignation that was effective over the summer. So by July, ODS, or ODR, more correctly, had one full-time staff member for an increased number of students, which was 700 at the time, which is almost a quarter of the entire student body and not far from the size of the conservatory as a whole. There was a September 23rd of this year, an email sent from Meredith Raimondo regarding communication from office staff members about how the office was functioning and its staffing issues. And the email basically said that those issues were not really to be communicated publicly, or that there really were not issues, was sort of the take on it. Some new part-time staff were hired, and then October 2nd, Isabella Moreno, the interim director, resigned suddenly. She was actually scheduled to leave the office, I want to say, at the end of the month.
The 31st.
So tomorrow, actually. But due to, according to her daughter, whose post circulated widely on Facebook, due to severe pressures of the job and having to handle a incredible workload that was way, 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 way more than she could be expected to do, she resigned unexpectedly. And so that created a sort of viral, at least Oberlin scale viral, social media post that was talking about that from her daughter. It really picked up a lot of steam among students, which sort of leads us almost to where we are right now, but not quite. Yeah.
No, that's great. Did you want to add anything, Sydney? I know that you've written sort of one of the main pieces for the review about the whole situation.
Yeah, no. One thing that I think could be made definitely a little bit clear is that part of the reason the staff shortages happened in the Office of Disability Resources is because with the deficit this year and with the budget constraints, the office has been trying to, or I suppose the administration, in restructuring many of the college departments. One aspect of that is having a lot of cross departmental staff, and I think that was lost in many of the Facebook posts that people were sharing and posting, that technically there were people who, you know, would flow in and out of the ODR, but it is correct to say that there was only one permanent staffer.
Yeah, I'm just actually going to quote part of your article, sort of what you wrote about that, because I thought it was really astute. But it says that the new model of cross-departmental supportive roles is the result of a series of austerity measures taken over the summer to reduce the operating budget in the Division of Student Life by 5%. And it sort of talks about, I think you talked about how other departments faced similar cuts, but they didn't end up sort of cutting things that have received this much attention.
Mm-hmm.
And
also part of this process has been a move of the Office of Disability Resources from its own sort of separate entity to being part of what's called the Center for Student Success, which involves a lot of staff members from what were previously a lot of discrete areas that are now all working in one office together on a lot of different things, which I think is very confusing. And most people still don't really know that the Center for Student Success exists.
Yeah, well, I think the whole restructuring is a little bit hazy to most students at the moment. I mean, that all stems from the dismantling of the Dean of Studies office, which used to house all sorts of, you know, random departments, and some administrators have described it to me as the former, you know, vice principal's office, where you only went when you got in trouble and didn't, you know, the principal didn't have time for you. So that's kind of why things are so crazy in terms of, you know, what falls under which umbrella, where things are located at the moment, because that department was just completely eliminated, and all of its moving parts were shifted to other areas on campus.
Yeah, I mean, I think just in general, maybe this is a result of my own ignorance, but I think in general, departments within Oberlin are pretty confusing for the average student. Most people don't necessarily know what goes on in which dean's office, which, I mean, I think is too bad. I don't really know what to do about that other than just drum it into students' heads, but that's not going to, you know, happen. Anyways, regardless of that, I think a lot of sort of the frustration has been directed at Vice President and Dean of Students Meredith Raimondo. Would you sort of consider that like a legitimate complaint, or are there other complaints that are, you know, reasonable?
I would definitely consider it somewhat reasonable. It is something that happened under her purview, and I think a lot of it stems from miscommunication that students did see, you know, less actual staff people in this office, that they didn't quite understand what was happening with the, you know, cross-departmental resources and everything. And also, there was a timing issue where I believe two of the part-time staffers didn't officially come to Oberlin until weeks into the semester. So it was Isabella Moreno working by herself for an extended period of time. And I definitely think that some balls were dropped and that there were some mistakes made. But, you know, since I can now state my opinion and I'm not writing a news article, I do think that there was a little bit of unfair shade tossed on Meredith.
I'd love to also jump in. I think a lot of the anger and frustration with Dean Raimondo stemmed from an email communication that circulated. And having read it and spoken to a bunch of students about it, and my own opinion as well, I think it's certainly fair to say that it doesn't come off great. I think that in a response to that being anger at Dean Raimondo, I completely understand. I think it's legitimate. I can understand, and again, I don't know that this was her sentiment, but reading it, if the sentiment behind it was, you know, please don't discourage people from thinking that we're trying to provide them with resources they need, and don't turn people away, that is a good sentiment. At the same time, I've spoken to a whole bunch of people who, it's just because of the understaffing, taken them so long to actually access the resources in that office. And if the reason staff members in that office are, quote unquote, complaining or whatever it is to students or parents about not having the resources they need, then maybe it's because they've tried other outlets and they feel like they're not being heard.
Yeah, and you know, the administration is responsible to a large degree for creating the work environment that the staffers of that office work in. And if they are so overworked that they're complaining to students, I get it, they probably shouldn't be vocalizing those concerns, but it stems from a larger issue that, you know, you're just passing the blame. I perceived it as Dean Raimondo passing the blame onto the office for what was really not their fault.
I absolutely agree with your assessment of why they would be in that position to complain and talk about it with students. It was a result of the circumstances, not anyone willfully trying to push students away. Absolutely.
Yeah. Continuing from that, I think this maybe is one of the first moments where we're going to see one of the things President Ambar talked about was sort of a conflict between values that the Oberlin has and the fiscal abilities it has to support those. Is that a good assessment of this? This sort of being like a headwater moment that's going to signal similar controversies to come, where funds aren't going to be allocated and people are going to be upset about that?
No, I entirely agree with that statement. I think what we saw in this instance was an attempt to kind of stretch resources thin and combine some positions in some departments to make those resources work. One of the big things that in the interim the Office of Disability Resources was doing was that it was having certain deans, especially Matthew Hayden, who, if you read any of the Facebook posts, he was one of the main targets for students, you know, emails and calling and all those things, having him work in the office temporarily and, you know, shifting other people and other deans and other temporary staffers to that office. So I really think there is going to be a lot of that in the future, of trying to kind of spread our resources as thin as possible. And that's part of, you know, the financial situation that we're currently in. And I, to be honest, I don't see that getting any better in the coming years or semesters.
And I think, you know, it obviously directly relates to hiring or not hiring for this office. But I think you more or less just summed up what's going to be facing Oberlin with every single issue for at least the foreseeable future. Our mission, our dedication to being progressive and taking care of our students' needs, and our bottom line.
And I think, you know, I think it's fair that, you know, we have financial issues. Okay, fine. You know, not everything is going to meet all students' needs as best it could if we were not in the financial situation that we're in. And I get that, and that's fine. I'm personally really frustrated with the way that this is all going down, which is to say that it's not, that's not being communicated honestly. I don't really feel like anyone is saying, from high up within the administration, this is something that we just don't have the ability to fix right now. There's no one is saying, you know, this is a real problem and we don't know how to deal with it, and we would like to collaborate with students on how to fix it. What's being said is, you know, we're doing cross training and it's great, and we're actually going to have more staffing hours. That's, I mean, it's, I'm glad that that's the, you know, analysis, but you can spin anything any way you want. It feels like we're at like a, you know, a political debate, and one candidate is like spinning their like tax plan and saying, oh, you know, the middle class is going to save this much money. Like, yeah, if you slice and dice it the right way, sure, but I don't think that means anything. And ultimately, like, disabled students are being very clear and very vocal about what they want and what they need. And people who are not disabled are telling them, no, that's not what you need. That's not what you want. Here's a better, shinier thing that we're doing that we came up with, which to me is just so ridiculous. And I sound ridiculous saying that because I'm not a disabled student. And I don't really know anything about that. And I can't imagine how it must feel to be a disabled student and have someone say that to you. It's profoundly frustrating. And it's like, performative allyship 101 is like acting like you care and then telling the person who's asking for your help what they need. Mm-hmm. It's like kind of boggles my mind a little bit. And it feels like something that has been happening more broadly, both with this administration and previous ones, I would say.
I am right there with you, Daniel. And I mean, for a school that loves to talk about allyship, you know, try listening and then doing your best to give students what they're telling you they need. Yeah. I understand you can't always just flip a switch, but to that end, I want to say to Daniel and to anybody listening who has questions for Dean Raimondo, questions about the Office of Disability Resources, this Thursday, November 2nd, at 7 p.m., King 106, Dean Raimondo will be hosting an open forum to talk about recent changes. This includes disability resources and, you know, student life at large. So come ask questions early and often.
Yeah, and to add on to that too, if you have questions, comments you'd like to give us right now in the booth, please do give us a call, 440-775-8139. We are close to the end of our show, but I'm thinking we've got time for one more question, if that's all right. Sure. I think one of the interesting parts of this story was the role that Facebook played and sort of how that really distributed news among the campus community, and sort of that clearly plays into a larger narrative nationally about how people get their news. We've got great news sources on campus. People are sitting right next to me, so I can say that. But what do you think the role that Facebook has played in sort of getting news out to students and?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I definitely think it was useful. I mean, anyone who was kind of following the, you know, spread of these messages can't deny that it spread like absolute wildfire through Oberlin, through the student body, and campus organizations, and I mean everyone knew about it by, I think it was the end of Monday. It happened around 2 or 3 p.m. and by the end of the day it was everywhere. And Matthew Hayden, of course, had I spoke to him, and he'd gotten dozens and dozens of emails and phone calls and such. So I definitely think it's useful. It does concern me that there is a very limited perspective in some cases, and that when misinformation might be involved, that also spreads like wildfire, and that also is something that gets disseminated at an extremely rapid and, you know, unstoppable pace. I mean, that's something we've seen. We see that nationally in the election, in, you know, the whole fake news discussion that's happening right now. So it's mildly concerning, but I'm hoping as a student body we can kind of figure out how to navigate that and how to really kind of pause and ask the in-depth questions of, am I getting the whole picture here before, you know, spreading more information.
Yeah. As a journalist who wants people to have complete information, I'm a little bit concerned. But as the other half of me wanting students to, you know, take up the pitchforks and make things happen, like, it works and it's very effective. And, like, more people, I think, know about the Office of Disability Resources story than the structural budgetary issues story because it circulated on Facebook. And that was something that I've noticed in talking to a lot of people, is a lot of people still don't really know about that because it never went around and made the rounds. But a lot more people know because of Facebook. So that's, you know, that's a blessing and a curse to some degree on both sides.
Totally. Well, thank you all so very much. I think we had a really great conversation on a lot of really applicable, relevant topics tonight. You can tune in, as always, next week. Please do give us a call. And Daniel has some special news.
Yes. So this is a very exciting time for The Weekly because we are a podcast now. You can find our podcast on the Apple Podcast app and on Google Play if you're on Android. Search The Weekly Oberlin and you should find it. The first three episodes of our show where we talk about the board, hiring freeze, and we talked to Peggy Orenstein are currently up. There will be two more episodes out this Friday at 5 p.m. with the paper. So please enjoy that, tune in, and get it wherever you get your podcasts. And Johan's going to play us out.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Daniel. And thank you, Sydney and Josh. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Pleasure to be here.
Always blessed.
And thank you for listening in. Again, you are listening to The Weekly. This is WOBC 91.5 Oberlin College and Community Radio. Thanks for listening.